The weather in the morning was the same as every other morning on Rekiad, freezing cold, with fierce winds and swirling snow that limited visibility. Revan had been hoping for a calm, clear day so they could use the basilisks to fly them up to the top. But even here at the base, unexpected gusts had enough strength to almost knock him off his feet. Higher up, the wind shear and lack of visibility would make an attempted landing on the summit suicidal, even for the most skilled pilots. Dangerous as it was, climbing to the top was the only real option.
"Bad conditions for an ascent,"
Candorous remarked as they stood at the base of the first spear.
"This is as good as it gets,"
Vela said.
"If you're scared, I'll get Edric to take your place, and you can watch over the camp."
"The old man would probably have a heart attack halfway up,"
Candorous answered with a grin.
"He's only a year older than you,"
Vela pointed out.
"But I'm like fine wine," he replied. "I get better with age."
The playful exchange eased some of Revan's concerns about the mission, though he still wasn't thrilled by the makeup of the climbing team. There were 8 of them in total: Revan, Candorous, Vela, and the 5 other basilisk riders, including Grizzer, the young man who'd given up his mount to Candorous. Vela's picks made a certain amount of sense. Going after Mandalore's Mask was a great honor, and the basilisk riders were among the most respected warriors in the clan. The only other person who might have been included was Edric, but he had been chosen to stay behind to lead Clan Ordo in case Vela and the others never came back. Yet Revan couldn't help noticing that all the climbers chosen knew he was a Jedi. And Edric, Candorous's oldest and most loyal friend, was being left behind. He wished he'd had a chance to talk to Candorous before they had left. Now all he could do was keep his guard up throughout the ascent, just in case. They broke into 2 teams of 4. The members of each team connected by a long length of climbing rope. Candorous, Revan, and 2 of the pilots made up the first group. Vela and the other 3 pilots the second. In addition to their winter clothing and gear, each climber had a 20-kilo pack of supplies and rations strapped across his or her shoulders. The 2 teams began their ascent simultaneously, moving along parallel paths up the sheer vertical surface of the wall of ice that made up the spear's face. Each meter of progress was earned only by hacking into the ice, chipping away with a sharp-ended pick to create a small hold for a hand or foot, then hammering a braced pulley into the wall to secure the climbing rope. The pattern was repeated again and again. Progress was slow and exhausting. A single misstep could send a climber plunging to a quick and gruesome death. Theoretically, the ropes and pulleys connecting each team should allow the other 3 members to bear the weight if one should fall. But none of them was inclined to test the theory. After only 50 meters, the roaring wind was already strong enough to rip away their voices, forcing them to communicate with simple hand gestures. Despite the cold, Revan was sweating heavily beneath his layers of clothing, his body warmed by the steady physical exertion as they battled their way meter by painful meter toward the top. At least he was safe from Vela for the time being. The difficult climb required total focus and concentration from every climber as they worked in concert to reach the peak. Even if the Ordo pilots were plotting against him, they simply wouldn't be able to try anything until they reached the plateau at the top. At the start of the climb, the summit was invisible, lost in the swirl of snow and clouds. But by the 5th hour, they had risen above the worst of the storm, giving them their first glimpse of the spear's peak, illuminated by Rekiad's pale orange sun. They were well over halfway to their goal, but exhaustion and fatigue were beginning to impede their progress. As the altitude increased, the air became thinner, leaving all the climbers panting and gasping. The pack strapped to Revan's back seemed to have doubled in weight, and he could feel the straps digging into his shoulders even through his clothes. But there was little to do except ignore the pain and concentrate on the climb. Vela's team was about 50 meters ahead. Suddenly, one of their riders lost his footing and slipped. He dropped 10 meters before the ropes abruptly stopped his fall, leaving him dangling helplessly at the end of the line. The abrupt stop had jerked his backpack partially around, twisting the shoulder straps so that his arms were partially pinned behind his back. Combined with the howling winds buffeting him back and forth, he was unable to reestablish a grip on the mountain. Vila and the others began the slow and careful process of climbing back down to help him. It took about 2 minutes for Revan's team to draw level with Vila and her crew as they backtracked to rescue the wayward climber. Realizing the situation was under control, Revan's team pressed on toward the top. 5 minutes after the fall, Revan glanced back down to see that all four of Vila's team were once again safely in position. They were not trying to regain the lead, but moved more slowly and cautiously than before. 2 hours later, Revan's team reached the top. Candorus was first, planting his feet firmly. He reached down to grab Revan's arm and haul him up. Revan did the same for the woman trailing behind him, and she did the same for the man behind her. The top of the first spear was a featureless plateau of slick ice, covered by a thin dusting of snow. Looking across the gap between the two spears, Revan could see that the other summit was as bare and featureless as this one.
"Now what?"
Candorus shouted over the roar of the wind.
"If this is the right peak, there should be an entrance around here somewhere,"
Revan yelled back. A gust of wind shoved him sideways, and he almost stumbled.
"An entrance to what?"
Revan only shrugged. His vision hadn't shown him what he and Malik had discovered, and no more memories had bubbled to the surface during their climb. They all set their backpacks on the ground and started a grid pattern search over the plateau's surface. It didn't take them long to find what they were looking for. Near the center of the plateau, under a dusting of snow, was a small, durasteel hatch. Revan grabbed the handle and pulled hard, calling on the Force to give him strength when he felt his muscles beginning to strain. Slowly, reluctantly, the heavy cover swung open to reveal a ladder leading down into darkness.
"You stay here and wait for Vila,"
Candorus ordered the other two Mandalorians.
"We'll go down and check it out."
He retrieved several glow sticks from his backpack on the ground, along with a blaster pistol. Revan didn't have a weapon in his pack. Everyone on the climb already knew he was a Jedi, and he was confident the lightsaber at his belt would be enough to deal with anything they ran into. Not that he expected any trouble. It was hard to imagine a more remote, isolated, and inhospitable location. It was easy to see why he had decided to hide Mandalore's mask here. But where was here, exactly? Why was there a secret underground chamber built into the spear? And how had he and Malik found it in the first place? Candorus walked over to the hatch and dropped one of the glow sticks into it. It tumbled down, illuminating the length of the shaft as it fell. It stopped some 30 meters below, bouncing, rolling, and then settling on the ground.
"After you!"
Candorus said. As Revan began the long descent, his mind started to spin. Brief flashes of dormant memories exploded into his consciousness, only to vanish before he could fully grasp them. He had an overwhelming sense of deja vu. He knew with certainty he and Malik had explored the dark chamber beneath the ice, just as he and Candorus were exploring it now. The sights and sounds of his previous visit blended with his current surroundings, the images overlapping one another, obscuring his vision and making him dizzy. It got so bad that Revan had to close his eyes, clinging to the rungs of the ladder with a tense grip.
"You okay?"
Candorus asked from a few meters above. His voice echoed loudly off the rough-hewn rock walls.
"My past is catching up with me," Revan explained, shaking his head to dispel the vertigo.
He waited a few more seconds, and when he opened his eyes again, everything had returned to normal. Taking a deep breath, he continued downward until he reached the bottom. The shaft ended in a tight, twisting tunnel that continued horizontally. Resisting the urge to draw his lightsaber, Revan pulled out another glow stick and started down the passage. Candorous followed close behind. The tunnel was narrow, forcing them to walk single file. But the ceiling was high enough that even Candorous didn't have to duck. It didn't take long for Revan to realize that they were walking on a slight decline, going ever deeper into the heart of the spear. The air around them grew warmer, causing them to unbutton their jackets and lower their hoods. As they continued on, Revan began to feel the unmistakable presence of the dark side. His hand dropped to his lightsaber at his belt, but he relaxed as he realized that the sensation was too faint to signify an immediate threat. Once, the Force had been strong in this place, but over time, many decades or even centuries, it had faded away to little more than a memory. Eventually, the passage brought them into a large circular chamber hewn from the rock. Easily 30 meters across, the chamber was empty, save for a large stone crypt in the center.
"What is this place?"
Candorous whispered. "I think it's the burial chamber of an ancient Sith Lord," Revan answered. "Like the tombs on Korriban."
"Why would they bury him here in this frozen wasteland?"
To his own surprise, Revan knew the answer to that question.
"He was an exile. He fled here with a handful of his fanatically loyal followers many centuries ago. When he died, they carved out this secret chamber to inter him so his enemies couldn't find and desecrate his remains."
"How do you know that?"
Revan shrugged. "I just know. Malak and I came here looking for this crypt. Something must have told us about it."
"You mean someone like Mandalore?"
Another memory came crashing in on Revan, triggered by the words of his friend. Mandalore the Ultimate lay dying at his feet. Coughing on the blood welling up in his lungs, he reached up and peeled off his mask, the most sacred symbol of his people.
"It wasn't supposed to end like this,"
he said, his voice soft and low.
"They promised me victory. Only now do I see how I was betrayed."
Revan tilted his head to the side, puzzled. "What are you talking about?"
"They tricked me. We were never meant to win this war. They used me and my people to test the Republic's strength."
"Who used you?"
"The Sith."
The recollection ended abruptly, slipping quickly back into Revan's subconscious. But in bubbling up to the surface, it had released a host of other trapped memories, and they crashed over Revan like a wave, staggering him.
"I remember,"
he muttered, placing his hand on the wall for support.
"I remember."
"What?"
Candorous asked anxiously.
"What do you remember?"
Revan didn't answer. Instead, he crossed the chamber to the sarcophagus in the center. Carved into the granite sides was an interweaving pattern of circles and diagonal lines, most likely a family crest or seal. The tomb's heavy stone lid was smooth and unadorned, but as Revan drew closer, he could see marks and scratches along the edges, signs that it had been moved several times. Reaching out to the Force, Revan focused on the lid. After a moment, it began to move, the edge grating along the lip of the lower half of the sarcophagus as it slowly rose into the air. Careful not to let the heavy lid drop, he moved it off to the side and gently lowered it to the floor. He stepped up to the sarcophagus and peered inside. There were no remains to be seen. The enemies of the anonymous Sith Lord in the tomb must have found him after all, stealing his mummified corpse for some dark and twisted purpose. The missing body didn't come as a surprise to Revan, and he suddenly remembered that he and Malak had also found the sarcophagus empty. But they hadn't left it that way. Inside was a datacron, a small cube similar to the holocrons used by the Jedi and Sith to record their teachings for future generations. However, unlike those powerful artifacts, the datacron was not created using the Force. It was simply a repository of information. But Revan barely looked at the datacron. His attention was gripped by the object that lay beside it. Mandalore's mask. And as he reached in and picked up the sacred relic, his mind flashed back to the moment he had left it there.
So Mandalore was telling the truth,
Malak said.
Did you really think his last words would be a lie?
Revan asked.
Now what?
We have our proof, Revan said. The Sith are not extinct. They have to be stopped.
What about the Mandalorians?
Without the mask, they are nothing,
Revan said, placing the mask inside the empty sepulcher. The memory ended, rudely snapping Revan back to the present. He lifted the mask and held it aloft so Candorus could see. The big man walked slowly toward him, as if in a daze. He didn't speak, but as he approached, his hands came up almost involuntarily, his fingers reaching out toward the lost symbol of his people. Neither noticed Vila and the others enter the chamber.
How dare you defile Mandalore's mask with your filthy Jedi hands!
Vila shouted, breaking the spell that had momentarily enthralled the two men. Revan looked up to see her standing at the cavern's entrance, flanked by the other climbers. All six Mandalorians were armed with blaster pistols, their muzzles aimed directly at the two men standing by the crypt.
Vila!
Candorus demanded.
What do you think you're doing?
Put the mask down and step away from the crypt,
she commanded, ignoring him. Moving slowly, so as not to alarm anyone, Revan placed the mask back in the crypt.
Avner fought beside us,
Candorus protested.
He led us to Mandalore's mask, and you repay him with a betrayal?
Vila barked out a harsh laugh.
Who are you to talk of betrayal? You turned your back on your people. And for what? To throw your lot in with Revan the Butcher?
When did you figure it out?
Candorus asked, not bothering to deny the truth.
Once he revealed himself to be a Jedi, it was obvious,
she said with a sneer.
Especially with that name. Do you really think rearranging Revan into Avner would fool us?
This isn't about him,
Candorus said.
It's about me, isn't it?
Vila bit down hard on her lip, but didn't answer.
I'm not here to claim the mask for myself,
Candorus assured her.
You're the rightful leader of Clan Ordo. I'm not here to challenge you.
You still don't get it,
Vila said, shaking her head.
You should be our leader, not me. You were our greatest warrior. You are our champion, our hero. When Mandalore fell, you should have been the one to take his place.
She looked at him sadly.
Instead, you abandoned us. You abandoned me.
I'm sorry,
Candorus said softly.
When our clan fell apart, I was lost. I had to get away. I didn't know what else to do.
You could have stayed and helped piece it back together,
Vila insisted, her voice cracking slightly as she lowered the blaster in her hand.
Seen Vatine,
Candorus said.
I can't undo the past, but I'm here now.
That's why I didn't tell the others in the camp,
she admitted.
I didn't want to destroy your reputation by telling them you fell in with Revan.
You didn't tell him because you're afraid they'd agree with me,
Candorus countered.
Revan is not our enemy. Not now. Without him, Clan Gendry would have slaughtered us. Without him, we never would have found Mandalore's mask. Revan has proven himself to be our brother, and what you're doing brings dishonor on our clan.
No! Vila insisted. You're wrong. Clan Ordo might accept a Jedi, but not him! Anyone but him!
There's only one way to be sure. We let the whole clan decide.
That's not an option,
Vila replied, raising her blaster back up.
Revan cannot leave this chamber alive.
You know Revan's reputation, Candorous warned. And mine. There may be six of you, but do you really think you have a chance against us both?
We're not here to kill you, Vila told him. Just him.
And you expect me to stand by and do nothing?
I expect you to join us!
Vila shouted.
You are Mandalorian. Clan Ordo is your family, not Revan. You have to choose. Him or us?
It doesn't have to be this way,
Candorous said evenly.
Lower your weapons, end this madness. We'll take Mandalore's mask back down to the camp together.
This is your last chance, Candorous,
Vila said.
Choose!
Her hand was trembling, making it difficult for her to aim, but the other five held their blasters steady and true.
You can't win this battle,
Revan said quietly, speaking more to the others than Vila.
We killed dozens of Jedi during the war,
Vila answered grimly.
I'm no ordinary Jedi.
Vila,
Candorous pleaded.
Please, don't do this.
Her shoulders slumped, and she let out a sigh of resignation.
Kill them both.
Revan was in motion, his lightsaber flashing to life before the words had finished spilling from her mouth. As Vila and two of the others, reacting slightly faster than the rest, fired their blasters, the green blade transformed into a spinning, twirling blur as he used it to deflect their bolts back in the direction of the shooters. One of the deflected bolts struck its mark, taking down the woman on Vila's left. Candorous and Revan dived for cover behind the sarcophagus just as the other Mandalorians opened fire. Candorous popped up briefly to fire, sending the Mandalorians breaking for cover. There were precious few places to hide in the open chamber, however, and Candorous took two of them down before they made it to safety. Vila and the other two survivors scrambled back into the passage near the chamber entrance, ducking out of sight around the corner to regroup. A second later, a trio of grenades skittered across the floor, bouncing and rolling to a stop near the base of the sarcophagus. The instant before they detonated, Revan reached out with the force and hurled the heavy stone lid of the sarcophagus toward the grenades. It acted as a shield, absorbing the worst of the blast, before exploding into pebbles of dust. The explosion was deafening, though. The concussive force strong enough to knock both Candorous and Revan off their feet. As Revan struggled to stand up, the only sound he could hear was a high-pitched ringing in his ears. Vila and her team seized the advantage and charged into the room, blaster pistols blazing. All three aimed at Revan, who just barely rolled clear in time. From the corner of his eye, he saw Candorous lying on his stomach, arms stretched out in front of him to brace his pistol on the floor as he took careful aim. An instant later, Vila went down from a clean kill shot. Their attention drawn for just an instant by the body of their leader tumbling to the floor, the two remaining Mandalorians faltered. Revan used that moment to unleash a sidearm throw of his lightsaber. The blade went spinning out in a wide, arcing path that ended both their lives before they could move. Revan adeptly caught his lightsaber by its hilt as it returned to his hand, then slowly stood up straight, his ears still ringing. Nearby, Candorous still lay on the floor, frozen in the same position he had been in moments earlier. Slowly, Revan approached him, trying to see if he was injured. The big man didn't move until Revan reached down and placed a hand on his shoulder. Then Candorous snapped his head around in surprise. He mouthed something, but Revan couldn't hear what he was saying, so he only shrugged in response. Candorus pushed himself up off his stomach and onto his feet, leaving his pistol on the ground. He walked over to where Vila lay face down on the floor and rolled her over. Her eyes were wide, gazing unseeing up at the ceiling. Tenderly, he closed the lids, then folded her hands over her chest. Then he stood up straight and turned away, staring off into an empty corner of the chamber. After a few minutes, Revan went over to stand beside him.
"I'm sorry."
His voice sounded strange to him. His hearing was still distorted by the grenade, and wasn't sure if Candorus had heard him.
"I'm sorry,"
he repeated, this time more loudly. Candorus turned his head to look at him.
"Me too,"
he answered, before turning to stare back at the wall, his words hollow and flat.
"Me too."
Chapter 14. Candorus continued to stare at the cavern wall, while Revan stood by in respectful silence. Eventually, he turned back to Revan and said,
"We shouldn't just leave them lying here like this. It's disrespectful."
Revan nodded. The Mandalorians still lay where they had fallen, their bodies crumpled in unnatural positions. Together, the two men gathered them up one by one and lay them down side by side in the center of the room. As he had done with Vila, Candorus closed their eyes and crossed their hands over their chests. If there had been any way to make a funeral pyre, Revan would have suggested they burn them in the Mandalorian custom, but with no fuel, that wasn't going to be possible.
"What am I going to tell the others?"
Candorus wondered once they were done arranging the bodies. Revan understood his dilemma. There would be a lot of questions when they returned alone with Mandalore's mask, and Candorus didn't want to bring shame on Davila's name.
"Keep it simple," Revan suggested. "Say we ran into unexpected resistance from guardian droids programmed to protect the crypt. Tell them Vila and the others died in battle, and they fought like true warriors before they fell."
Candorus nodded, then slowly walked over to the sarcophagus. He took out Mandalore's mask, then, almost as an afterthought, picked up the Datacron.
"What's this?"
he asked, looking curiously at the small cube.
"It's a chronicle of the Sith Lord who was buried here," Revan said. "I think Malak and I found it hidden in the tomb the last time we were here." "Do you remember what's on it?"
"Mostly."
"Tell me."
Revan knew Candorus was hoping there would be something in the history that would help him understand why Vila had turned on him. From what Revan remembered of the story, it would offer little solace. But he wasn't about to deny the request.
"His name was Lord Draymith II. 1,000 years ago, his father, the original Lord Draymith, ruled over a planet called Medrios. He was overthrown by another Sith named Lord Vitiate, who renamed the planet Nathema. With his father's death, the younger Lord Draymith fled. He hid on Rekiad with a handful of loyal followers, and when he died, they buried him here with the Datacron."
"So it has nothing to do with Mandalore or his mask?"
Candorus asked, shaking his head.
"You just decided to hide it here, too?"
Revan hesitated for a moment.
"Actually, it has everything to do with Mandalore," he said finally.
Candorus had a right to know the truth, but first Revan had to put all the pieces back together for himself. Coming to the underground burial chamber had triggered the return of a host of lost memories. They had come to him in disconnected scraps and momentary flashes of insight. He needed time to process the information, to sort it into something that made some kind of sense.
"Can we talk about this later?" was all he said.
Candorus studied Revan's face, seemed about to say something, but then nodded.
"Let's get some rest,"
he suggested.
"We can make it back down the mountain tonight anyway. We can talk in the morning."
Spending the night exposed on the plateau's surface wasn't an option, not while they could stay underground in a geothermally heated cavern that was sheltered from the elements. They unrolled their sleeping bags near the edge of the chamber, as far away from Vila and the other bodies as possible. Sharing the room with six corpses was unpleasant, but it was better than freezing to death. Neither man slept well. Revan could hear Candorus tossing and turning. Once, Revan thought he heard him whisper Vila's name. Revan's thoughts wouldn't let him sleep either. He had hoped finding Mandalore's mask would be a breakthrough, the key to unlocking all his lost memories. But the more he tried to reassemble the fragmented images swarming in his head, the more he realized how much was still missing. He had taken only a small step forward, and he suspected the journey was far from over. When sleep finally overcame him, he dreamed about the world of endless storms and perpetual night again. It seemed more vivid than before, more substantial, more real. He couldn't say how long he slept. It was difficult to sense the passage of time in the chamber. When he woke, he didn't feel refreshed, but he knew it was pointless to try to go back to sleep. Candorus was already up, pacing slowly back and forth from one side of the chamber to the other, staring at the mask he held in his hands. Revan stood up and stretched, working the kinks out of his neck and shoulders. "I'm ready to tell you what I remember about Mandalore," he said, "if you still want to know."
"I do."
Taking one last breath to help gather his thoughts, Revan launched into the tale. "About 2 years before he declared war on the Republic, Mandalore was approached by a man with skin the color of blood. A Sith."
"I thought the Jedi wiped the Sith out."
"So did the Jedi. The Sith species vanished after the Great Hyperspace War. One of their kind hasn't been seen in Republic space in over 1,000 years. But this red-skinned being came to Mandalore. He claimed to be the emissary of a powerful master, a descendant of the Sith Lord who had driven Draymith into exile, and convinced Mandalore to help him search for his enemy's tomb." Revan was speaking slowly, the words coming out only as fast as the details came into focus. His recollections were still hazy and jumbled. The original time and place of each specific memory was unclear. Mandalore had told him some of this. Other details had come from the Datacron and the tomb. Most of it he had learned much later, after he and Malak had journeyed into the unknown regions themselves. It was impossible to sort it all out. Out of necessity, his damaged mind had collapsed his memories into one another, merging them into a semi-coherent whole as he'd slept. "Mandalore helped the Sith find Draymith's hidden crypt," he continued. "The Sith took the remains to give to his master, and in exchange, he told Mandalore of a vision his master had had of the Mandalorians rising up against the Republic. He told him they would conquer world after world, crushing their enemies, until the Republic collapsed in on itself. He promised the Mandalorians a glorious victory, and Mandalore believed him."
"Mandalore the Ultimate wouldn't lead us into war with the Republic just because some stranger told him we'd win,"
Candorus protested. "It's more complicated than that. The Sith used the power of the dark side to manipulate him. Only as Mandalore lay dying at my feet was the spell finally broken, and he realized he'd been tricked. That was why he told me about this place, so I could come and see for myself."
"This doesn't make any sense," Candorus said. "You say the Sith tricked Mandalore into attacking the Republic. But why?"
"I don't know," Revan admitted. "Maybe it was a test of your strength, or ours. Maybe the Sith are planning another invasion, and they sought to weaken the Republic."
"But you don't know for sure?"
"I'm remembering more and more, but there's still so much missing." Revan paused before adding, "Maybe I'll find the answers on Nathema."
"Nathema?"
"The hyperspace coordinates are on the Datacron. I think Malak and I went there to try to learn more.
Is Nathema the world you keep dreaming about? The one covered in storms and darkness?
Candorous asked. Revan closed his eyes and concentrated, summoning the image that had haunted him for so many nights. He tried to associate the vision with the name, but somehow he knew it didn't fit. No, the planet in my dreams isn't Nathema.
You sure?
I can't really be sure of anything, Revan confessed. But it just doesn't feel right. I think we went there after Nathema.
And when you returned, you tried to conquer the Republic. Just like Mandalore.
Revan shook his head. It's not the same. Mandalore was a warrior, and he had no loyalty to the Republic. Convincing him to attack was more persuasion than domination. The Sith was only telling him what he wanted to hear. He was playing off Mandalore's own hidden desires. But Malak and I were Jedi. It would take more than some persuasive words and a subtle push from the Force to turn us to the dark side. Something else happened to us out there. We found something that changed us.
You don't think going to Nathema again is a little risky?
Candorous asked.
I have to, Revan answered. It's the only way I'll find out what happened.
What if the same thing happens again?
I'll be more careful this time. My guard will be up.
Do you think that's gonna make a difference?
I hope so.
So when do we leave?
You're not coming, Revan said. You have to stay here with your people. He held up his hand to cut off any protests. Vila was right about one thing. You should be the leader of the Mandalorians. The mask is there, just waiting for you to claim it.
You need my help,
Candorous insisted.
I turned my back on Vila when she needed me. I'm not going to make the same mistake with you.
That's why you have to stay,
Revan told him.
The Mandalorians were tricked into a war that nearly destroyed them. I don't know who the Sith was or what he was after, but he knew you couldn't win. He knew a war against the Republic would leave the Mandalorians devastated.
If the Sith are planning another invasion of the Republic, they'd have to come through Mandalorian space first,
Candorous muttered.
Maybe they were trying to get us out of the way.
Maybe. Or maybe they wanted to twist your culture and beliefs in the hope you'd join them.
Many of the Mandalorians are bitter and hungry for revenge. Without a new Mandalore, how hard would it be for someone to manipulate them into going to war again? Revan frowned.
Your people have lost their way, Candorous. You need to help them find it again. The fate of the galaxy could depend on it.
Candorous stared at Revan, and then down at the mask in his hands. He stood stock still for a moment. Then, slowly, he raised the mask and slipped it over his head.
Mandalore has returned, he declared. I am Mandalore the Preserver, and I will restore the honor and glory of my people.
T3M4 greeted Revan's return to the Ebon Hawk with a shrill stream of beeps and whistles. The astromech was spinning in place so rapidly that Revan feared he might burn out a circuit.
Settle down, little fella, he said, reaching out to pat the droid. I'm glad to see you too.
T3 stopped spinning and responded with an inquisitive chirp.
Candorous is staying here, Revan explained. These are his people. This is where he belongs.
T3 beeped twice.
No, we're not going home yet,
Revan said, settling into the pilot's chair and punching in their hyperspace coordinates.
We're headed into the unknown regions, to a planet called Nathema.
Chapter 15.
Scourge knew that Nyriss was watching him carefully. For the past week, ever since she had told him the truth about Zedrix, he had felt her presence constantly. He had promised not to act on his knowledge until he saw Nathema for himself, and he intended to keep that promise. He knew she didn't trust him, and he knew she'd try to kill him if she felt threatened, and also that she was powerful enough to have a good chance of succeeding. But he had his own reasons for obeying. He was curious about what she had told him. He wanted to know more about the Emperor's mysterious past. And if it turned out that Nyriss was telling the truth, if the Emperor really was mad enough to start another war with the Republic, then maybe Scourge should consider taking her side. Now the day of reckoning was here. Nyriss had come for him early, waking him with a subtle whisper in his ear.
It's time.
He dressed quickly, then followed her out to the spaceport, where a private shuttle was waiting for them. Unlike the rest of her fleet, this one bore neither her colors nor her crest. This journey would be conducted in utter secrecy. The shuttle was clearly built for speed. There was no armor to speak of, and at first glance it was easy to miss the single blaster turret mounted under the cockpit. Scourge was no expert on starship weaponry, but he guessed it would only be effective at close range. The interior was more functional than luxurious, with room to seat six. On this trip, he and Nyriss would be the only passengers. She settled into the pilot's chair, her fingers moving rapidly over the controls with a dexterity that belied their gnarled, wrinkled appearance. Neither of them spoke as the shuttle took to the sky, climbing rapidly through the clouds and lightning until it broke free of the atmosphere. Nyriss made a few more adjustments and punched in the route, and the ship jumped into hyperspace, leaving Droman Koss and Nyriss's loyal followers behind.
"Nothing I tell you can prepare you for what you will see on Nathema," Nyriss warned him. "But I will tell you the history of the Emperor and his homeworld."
"How can I know you're telling the truth?"
She shrugged.
"Believe it or not as you see fit. If nothing else, it will help pass the time."
She settled herself more comfortably, and as she spoke, her voice took on the sing-song tone of a children's storyteller.
"The Emperor's name was Tenebri," she began. "They say he was born with eyes as black as the void of empty space, and that he never cried, even as an infant. No animal would come near him, and when he began to talk, his voice carried a weight and power that should not come from a child. At the age of six, he began to manifest signs of the Force, marking him as one of the ruling elite. But his parents were simple farmers, and the Force was not strong in them. Suspicious about the boy's power, his father confronted his mother, who admitted to having an affair with the Sith Lord who ruled over them. The father flew into a rage, attacking the boy's mother. Tenebrae stopped him, feeding on his father's anger and hate to call upon the dark side. He snapped his father's neck with a mere thought, killing him instantly. His mother died more slowly. Tenebrae made her suffer for months as punishment for betraying the family, torturing her with the Force as he honed his powers. Now orphaned by his own hand, he made the others in his village bow down to him. Those who refused, he tortured and killed through the Force. Over the next few years, his reputation and influence spread to nearby villages, and he amassed legions of both fanatical and terrified followers. He killed thousands during his rise to power. Many died just to feed his insatiable appetite for suffering, tortured for days in public executions so he could savor their agonizing ends.
This sounds more like a legend than history, Scourge remarked.
I cannot guarantee the truth of this story, Nyriss admitted. Those who witnessed the events no longer live to verify them. But if you had ever met the Emperor in person, you would not be so hesitant to accept the tale as fact.
What about Nathema's ruler, the boy's father?
You claimed he was a Sith Lord. Surely he didn't sit back doing nothing while a child conquered his people village by village.
Tenebrae's father was named Lord Dremeth. He heard rumors, but they came from a remote and insignificant territory. He had long forgotten the simple commoner who had borne him a son, and he considered the plight of a few small villages beneath his notice. Had Dremeth acted more swiftly, the Emperor might have been stopped. But it took almost 4 years before he decided to go see Tenebrae for himself. Lord Dremeth intended to judge the child's power, to determine if he was worthy of serving the Sith Lord, or if he should simply be executed. But Tenebrae had no intention of serving, or of dying. When they met face to face, Tenebrae proved the stronger. Only 10 years old, he stripped his father of his power and his mind. Lord Dremeth spent his last moments weeping in terror, gazing up into the black eyes of his son. It took Tenebrae 3 more years to gain control of the rest of Nathema. Dremeth's firstborn son fled rather than face his formidable half-brother, but other powerful Sith sought to seize the empty throne. All fell before the dark prodigy, and with each victory, he grew more powerful and more ruthless. At 13, he presented himself to Mark Aragnos, the lord of all the Sith and the ruler of the Sith Council. Impressed by the teenager's ambition and power, Mark Aragnos granted him the title of Lord Vitiate. His position as ruler of Nathema officially recognized, Lord Vitiate returned to his home to conduct his research into the depths of the dark side's power. He stayed there for 100 years. When Mark Arachnos fell, Lord Vitiate did not join in the mad rush to claim his position. He was not part of the great hyperspace war against the Republic. When Noga Sadao and Ludo Kresh fought for leadership of the Sith, he took no side. But in the aftermath of the war, after our defeat at the hands of the Republic, and our flight to escape the massacre of our people by the Jedi, he emerged from his solitude to call a great council of all Sith lords who remained. He invited them to his palace on Nathema, built on the site of his childhood home, the place where he had killed his adopted father and tortured his mother to death. He invited them to participate in the ritual to unlock the full potential of the dark side. He promised they would unleash power beyond anything they had ever witnessed or imagined.
Didn't they suspect a trap?
Perhaps, Nyra shrugged. Some refused to answer his call, but many more came. After all, what could one man do against 100 Sith Lords? Remember, he was not the Emperor back then. He was merely Lord Vitiate, ruler of a single planet of no particular importance. He hadn't fought in any battles of note or achieved any great victories or conquests beyond his own world. He had the reputation of a scholar, not a warrior. And the Sith Lords were driven by fear. Many thought the Jedi would soon wipe them all out. They were desperate for anything they could use as a weapon against the servants of the light side. Lord Vitiate played upon these fears, convincing those who answered his call to set aside their suspicions of him and of one another, to join in a single glorious cause. Once they arrived on Nathema, they quickly fell under Lord Vitiate's control. He dominated their minds, crushed their resistance. He turned them into slaves of his will, forcing them to participate in the most complex ritual of Sith sorcery ever attempted. Calling on the dark side, Lord Vitiate devoured them. He fed on their power, absorbing it into himself, utterly obliterating all traces of his victims. But the ritual was not confined to the doomed Sith Lords. They were but the eye of the storm, the center of a vortex that spread across the entire planet. Every man, woman, and child on Ithema died that day. Every beast, bird, and fish, all the insects and plants, every living being touched by the Force, was consumed. When the ritual ended, Nathema was no longer a world. It was a husk, sucked dry. Lord Vishiat sacrificed millions, stealing their life force to make himself immortal. Their deaths also made him stronger than any Sith who had come before, and he ceased to be known as Lord Vishiat. On that day, the Emperor was truly born.
Scourge wondered if Nyriss expected him to be horrified by the tale. If so, she was about to be disappointed.
"The Emperor seized what was his by right," he said. "The strong take from the weak. That is our way. Doing it on a scale of millions doesn't change anything. It just proves he deserves to be our Emperor."
"So I used to think," Nyriss said, smiling ghoulishly. "And then I saw Nathema for myself."
She didn't say anything else for the remainder of the trip, leaving Scourge to wonder in silence why she was so confident he would come around to her side. He felt the first hints of what was waiting for him when the shuttle dropped out of hyperspace. Through the windows of the cockpit, he saw a gray and brown planet looming large before them. Gazing at it, he felt something strange and unsettling. Something unnatural. It took him several moments to realize what was wrong, and even when he did, he didn't fully grasp the implications. He wasn't feeling the Force. The sensation was completely alien. The Force was omnipresent. It radiated stronger in certain places and at certain times, and the balance of the dark side and light constantly shifted, but it was always there in some way, shape, or form. Now, however, he felt nothing. He had become so accustomed to the presence of the Force in the background that its complete absence was almost overwhelming, leaving him unable to speak.
"Prepare yourself," Nyriss said. "We're going down to the surface."
The absence grew steadily more pronounced as the shuttle approached and then landed on Nathema.
"Come with me,"
Nyriss commanded, rising up from her seat. Still mute, Scourge followed her down the shuttle's boarding ramp and out onto the world itself. They had touched down at the spaceport in a city, or what used to be a city. The spaceport was surrounded by the buildings, speeder pads, and streets one would expect to see in a planet's major metropolitan center. But it was eerily quiet. The incessant murmur of the crowds and the constant hum of traffic whizzing past on busy streets were missing. There wasn't even any wind, and the air tasted stale in Scourge's mouth. The temperature was neither cold nor hot, but he felt himself starting to shiver.
"You feel the chill of the void," Nyriss told him. "The Force is energy. It gives heat to our emotions and our minds. But here, it has been stripped away."
She led him along the deserted streets, as Scourge stared in fascinated horror, trying to grasp the magnitude of what he was witnessing. The buildings seemed to be almost fully intact. There was none of the damage and destruction normally associated with millions of simultaneous deaths. However, there were other signs of what had happened here. Mangled speeders and shuttles were strewn about, the remains of vehicles in motion that had crashed to a halt when their pilots were taken by the ritual. And everywhere Scourge looked, there were small piles of clothes, jackets, slacks, and boots that had survived what their owners had not. Normally, these remains would have been picked over by scavengers. But on Nathema, even the vermin and insects were extinct.
"Where are the droids?"
Scourge asked. He was shocked at the sound of his own voice. It was flat and dull, as if even sound waves had been distorted by the ritual.
"The ritual overloaded their circuits,"
Nyriss explained. Her voice is hollow and washed out as his.
"The damage was irreparable. Even their memory cores were completely wiped out."
Scourge glanced upward and noticed something else unusual. The sun shining down on them from above, a star that had appeared bright orange as they'd approached the planet, was now a pale shade of brown. In fact, everything around them was either brown or gray, as if the colors had been leached out. Scourge was well acquainted with death. He had no trouble understanding massacres and mass slaughter. Death and destruction unleashed powerful emotions like fear, suffering, and hatred. They fueled the power of the dark side. But what had happened on Nathema was different, and it disturbed him in a deep and profound way. The Emperor had consumed everything. Life, sound, color, even the Force. Nothing remained. This wasn't about conquest or domination or destroying an enemy, all concepts Scourge embraced. Everything on Nathema had simply been snuffed out, extinguished so completely that it ceased to have any meaning or purpose. It was a vacuum of existence, a blight on the natural order.
"I've seen enough," he declared.
Nyriss nodded, and they turned and made their way back to the ship. Scourge finally understood why Nyriss and the others wanted to take the Emperor down. Destroying your enemies, even destroying a planet, was understandable. But this wasn't simple destruction. It was annihilation. Obliteration. The very fabric of the Force had been shredded. Anyone capable of turning an entire planet into a nihilistic abomination had to be completely mad. After seeing the horrors of Nathema, he truly believed the Emperor might declare another war against the Republic, exposing them to the Jedi and leading to the eventual extinction of their species. By the time they reached the shuttle, Scourge's stomach was churning. He had lived his whole life attuned to the Force. Having it stripped away had left him physically ill. The shuttle shook as they took to the air, and he fought against the urge to vomit. As they broke the atmosphere of the cursed world, some semblance of normalcy returned. Scourge felt the Force rushing in to fill the emptiness inside him. He felt its power invigorating him and restoring his strength. At the same time, he also felt something else. The presence of someone strong in the Force. Someone who is neither Nyriss nor him. Nyriss suddenly began punching away at the shuttle's controls, scanning the system for another vessel, and Scourge knew she felt it too.
"There," she said, pointing at the readout. "The ship just dropped out of hyperspace in the system."
"Could the Emperor have sent someone to follow us?" Scourge asked.
"I don't think so,"
she replied, staring at the screens.
"Its signature doesn't match any design I've ever seen before."
From her voice, it was clear she was as puzzled as he was. If the ship hadn't followed them here, the odds against it showing up at the same time they were here were astronomical. But Scourge understood the ways of the Force too well to believe in coincidence. There had to be some connection between them and the unexpected visitor.
"Looks like a small freighter of some kind," Nyriss muttered. "I don't think they've seen us."
Scourge realized they had two options. The first was to make a quick jump to hyperspace in an effort to escape before being noticed. Nyriss decided to take the second option. Reaching out a finger, she activated the shuttle's ion cannon, locked on to the unidentified vessel, and fired. The instant the Ebon Hawk dropped out of hyperspace near Nathema, Revan was overwhelmed by a barrage of mental images. Everything came crashing in.